Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Hope you're enjoying your Sunday afternoon. It's time for the Sunday Paper Review with the football correspondent of the Irish Daily Mail, Philip Quinn, and the former All-Ireland winner with the Dublin 80s footballers and current athletic development coach with the Dublin senior hurlers, Cliona O'Connor. I'll just go through the back pages. Quite a quiet Sunday paper kind of afternoon, but there's a lot of interesting things inside the paper. So I think the back pages are a little bit mild for what sometimes you would expect on a Sunday paper review. Gory Man United. This is at the back of the Irish Sun. Wolves back to KO them as OGS fumes. This is at the back of that. And glory Tottenham Hotspur about Gareth Bale's move back to Spurs. Bale's back and he wants silverware. And Spurs have won today by 5-2. That is the back of the Sun. The Sunday Mirror. Palace coup. Very good. The Sunday Mirror, which fuming United boss Ole Gunnar Solskjaer tells the Stars to take a good look at themselves, which they probably needed to do after that 3-1 defeat to Crystal Palace yesterday. That is the back of the Sunday Mirror. The Sunday World, Donegal lockdown. This is about this story that there is a positive test seen training scrapped. So a member of Donegal senior football squad has tested positive for COVID-19. Collective training, which resumed on Tuesday night, has been suspended until the results of all the players' tests are available and the appropriate public health measures are implemented. Probably not the first one of these we're going to see. Written by Sean McGoldrick, back of the Sunday World. And United's spot of bother after this VAR issue. And then Wilfred Zaha scoring a penalty in the second half for Crystal Palace yesterday. It was refereeing issues and VAR issues clouding the fact that United, as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer even said, were not at it yesterday. That is the back of the Sunday World. The People, Crystal Ball. Solskjaer didn't see the Palace coup coming and says we are already playing catch up, which is not a good thing to see from a Man United manager. They had a week more than everybody else. I know they had a Europa League campaign, but they had a week more than everybody else. The Sunday Times, David Walsh sees the greatest Tour de France finale in 30 years as Pogacar snatches the title from Roglic. But obviously, this is all about Sam Bennett. Double trouble. Zaha strikes twice to get Man United's season off to the worst possible start. And Cullen, who we heard before three, we got spooked by stunning Saracens. That is the front page of the Sunday Times Sport. The Sunday Independent, Blues have no answer to power play. This is Saracens, the shock win for Saracens over the unbeaten Leinster, who are now defeated. Yesterday, boy in the water, we'll get to this in a moment, Gary O'Toole speaking to Paul Kimmage, and Palace pounding Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, suffering a nightmare start to Manchester United's season. That isn't the Sunday Independent. Nothing really much in the news sections. Shane Ross has spoken about John Delaney. We'll get to that in a bit. Crunched, this is the back of the Irish Daily Mail, the Sunday Mail. Leinster dumped out of Europe as Cullen's men have no answer for the power of Saracens. So that's the kind of the back pages. Manchester United obviously featuring largely in that, and Chelsea and Liverpool will tomorrow. So we're going to get to the Mail, I think, first, actually, and the story about Sam Bennett, which is interesting in the back as well of the Sunday Independent. Philip, you were there in 1989 when Sean Kelly was the last Irish green jersey wearer. So bringing back memories of Sam Bennett achievement today.
Yeah, hard to believe, John, it's 31 years ago. And I decided to wear a green T-shirt today in honour and respect to link Sean Kelly and Sam Bennett and the Tour de France. I'm just television on the corner here. The real deep part is about to take place now in the final run into Paris. Bennett is almost there. I think if he gets any points in the intermediate sprint, that'll do him. But I wouldn't rule out Sagan trying to come up with something. Peter Sagan is a fierce competitor, and I think he's won a record number of green jerseys. So we could have a little bit of a twist in the tail. We had a twist in the tail yesterday, obviously, in the time trial. So Bennett, almost there. The extraordinary story. I have the Daily Mail here, Irish Daily Mail on Sunday. Mail on Sunday, my colleague Mark Gallagher has done a very fine piece, sort of a background analysis of Sam Bennett's rise through the ranks, and a lovely headline there, A Sure Thing, a little play on words. And, you know, a couple little things that people may or may not know. Like, he was born in Belgium, and you might kind of ask, how was he born in Belgium? Because he did cycle there later on. He was born in Belgium because his father, Mick Bennett, who played for Waterford United, played in an FAI Cup final in 1986. He was playing in Belgium for a few years, and Sam was born there, but he moved back to Carrick and Shore, and he's been there since the age of four. And when you think about it, you know, that Carrick and Shore story is extraordinary, really, that a small South Tipperary town, and I mean that in a nice possible way, I've been down there many times, a lovely part of the world, that it has produced two extraordinary cyclists in Sean Kelly and now Sam Bennett. And as you say, 31 years on, I did a little retro piece for the Mail on Sunday today over here in this corner, where I was recalling how four journalists spent 3 weeks in the car in the Tour de France. Not an easy thing to do, to spend 3 weeks in the car with three colleagues. And we shared press rooms, we shared hotel rooms. We never had a room on our own. We got cranky. We probably were a bit annoyed at one another at times. But we had some great stories and some great laughs. And I remember the final day on the Champs-Élysées, Sean Kelly came from 10th to 9th and he got the green jersey. But that wasn't the story of the day, as you will recall. The story of the day was Laurent Fignon's collapse, if you like, although he had his second fastest ever time trial, but he was caught out and passed on the final day by Greg LeMond, who had this sort of fancy bike with the sort of disc wheels and the sort of fork-like handlebars, and no one could believe that LeMond could have caught Fignon. And it was the last time the Tour de France had a time trial finish on the Champs-Élysées. They said it would never work, lacked the drama, but that day was extraordinary drama, and Fignon collapsed on the tarmac afterwards. Couldn't believe he'd given everything, and LeMond had come from nowhere to catch him. And I remember my colleague John Brennan of the Irish Press came up with a great intro. Fair play to him. And his intro was along the lines of the length of time it will take you to read this sentence is the gap that separated Greg LeMond and Laurent Fignon after 3,000 miles of hard racing. It was a great intro, and that was an extraordinary story. But we have another story today, and as I say, Mark Gallagher has given the nuts and bolts, all the background about Sam Bennett and how the Tour de France went through Carrick and Schur in 1998. And he was a seven-year-old, and even then he was regarded as a young phenomenon. And what a story it would be today when he wears green, and we're wearing green for Sam Bennett on the Champs-Élysées today.
Absolutely, and Greg LeMond nearly died in a shooting accident before he came back and won that Tour in 89. And I'm reading this at the back of the Sunday Independent from Eamon Sweeney, Cliona. Today, Sam Bennett, the second green jersey winner from a small Irish town of just over 5,000 people, will have his hour of glory as the greatest finale to one of the world's greatest sporting events unfolds in the world's greatest city. C'est magnifique.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great story. And as Philip was saying there, when two people, two greats of one sport come from a little town, all the sports psychologists and everything start digging into it. And is it role modeling, and what is it about that place? But it's a great day for Sam and the last couple of days. And it's a good story for Irish cycling.
Absolutely. And also in that paper, the lead is Paul Kimmage speaking to Gary O'Toole, Cliona.
Yeah, it's what we've come to expect from Paul in terms of his personal interviews, and he sets it up in a really personal fashion, and it's a fantastic piece on page 2 and 3 of the Indo, a fantastic piece on a subject matter which isn't great.
No, and sensitive content here, yeah.
No, very sensitive content, and it's really, really well written, and it's a really, it pulls you in from the very beginning. I mean, Paul, he's obviously known Gary for a long time, and you can tell that throughout the piece. And it gives a good background to, reminds us, I suppose, of the nature of Gary's achievements in swimming. Introduces us to his swimming coach when he was in school, Gwen Collins, and yes, paints this beautiful picture of his first swimming coach who pretty much just let him at it, let him figure it out. There's a lovely piece where Gary says, it was our PE teacher, Gwen Collins, who taught me to swim. She had just graduated from the NIHE in Limerick in the same class or group as the likes of Brian Mullins. And she was an extraordinary coach insofar. She didn't know a lot about swimming, but she knew enough to find out where to learn. She got this book, The Science of Swimming, by the head coach at Indiana, who would coach Gary Hall Senior and Mark Spitz. And she would open a page and say, see that there? That's the way you're supposed to be looking in the water. Swim down there and see if you can make it look like that. And I had had an ability to mimic what I saw, which for any of us involved in coaching, there's a train of thought of, you know, don't be over coaching, just let people at it. And obviously this woman, Gwen, who since went on to become a nun, but obviously had a massive impact on Gary and sent him a birthday card. And he talks really, really fondly of her. And I mean, the scale of the piece itself, or the context of the piece itself, it sets up a lovely comparison, or a stark comparison as opposed to lovely, between her influence and what he felt from her. And then when he went on to meet George Gibney, and the, I suppose, the type of coach he was and the impact he had. And he talked about, you know, that when George Gibney started coaching him and Gary was young, and he was winning community games, at that point, Gary wasn't George's meal ticket. It was the older guys. And he was, Gary says, I was the sporting equivalent of a pension plan that would mature in a couple of years. So he wasn't paying much attention. It just, I mean, the whole piece, I suppose, and it looks like it's the first in maybe a series of them, but it really sets the tone and sets a stark comparison of a really human, connected, powerful coach of a young, talented swimmer, and somebody who really, I suppose, ran a very, very divisive and toxic swimming club.
Yeah, and you'd hope there's justice here. I mean, I hope there's justice out of this. That's obviously been highlighted in certain areas and by Paul today. And I think the one thing I wanted when I kind of read this this piece with Gary O'Toole is I wanted to read more, which is obviously always the thing. Interesting to be talking about Michelle Smith. I last saw Michelle probably in 97, late 97. I don't know, actually, I'm trying to think whether I've seen her since the drugs test with Alan Kegai in, what, 1998? But also Paul just putting out at the start how, you know, big Gary O'Toole was at the time. Like, you know, he was a European silver medalist. He had the world at his feet, really.
He did, and that, again, that came across, and he described winning the European, second in Europe, and then being on the plane and Chalky, as his nickname is, asking him about his experience of Gibney, and then I suppose his whole swimming world coming crashing down, and being sitting on a plane thinking, what am I going to do with this? And he's quick to point out that he doesn't blame any subsequent performances or anything on that, but in terms of his whole relationship with swimming and relationship with the head coach of Ireland, I think that changed a lot, as it would. And even Gary gives a good example of how, I suppose, his attitude to swimming changed, that he was sort of relentless and grumpy and didn't really engage with other swimmers. And then he, on a training camp in Arizona, I think it was in 89, he meets a swimmer called Willie Johnson, who was a former an REC officer from Belfast, and I suppose it gave him a whole new perspective on being a bit more relaxed and engaging with your teammates and enjoying it a little bit more. And he said that, and that taught me a lesson. I realized I would have none of those stories that these other swimmers had if I kept going the way I was going. So I started to cop on and relax a bit more. And that was just before he won that silver medal in the European Championship. So, there's a lot in it. There's Gary's personal relationship with swimming and his ups and downs, and when he performed and won and when he didn't. And then there's the bigger story of George Gibney.
Yeah, it's an excellent piece, which we will discuss, I'm sure, next week and going forward. It's been a tough week for Irish racing, Philip. It's like I wrote about it myself on the website here for OTB Sports and on the app about Pat Smullen. Like, it's like as Eamon Sweeney writes today, the death seems extraordinarily unfair. The life was undeniably great, and the good this man did will live long after.
Yeah, a huge loss for Irish racing, a huge loss for Irish sport. And John, you're one of the journalists that tries to keep racing to the forefront. You know, as a radio broadcaster, and I try and do a little bit for the newspaper, for the Mail as well. It's not always easy to do it. You know, you're up against the Leviathans of football, GAA and rugby. But I think even people in those sports were aware of Pat Smullen's goodness as a person. And I think the outpouring of grief and sincerity towards him after he passed is an example of the esteem in which he was held. When the news came through late the other night, and I was just doing a few paragraphs for the Mail, I had a quick Google, just because I remember the Harzan Derby, Epsom Derby, and you appreciate good jockeys, and his ride that day, I think if you look back on it, you know, he had Aidan O'Brien, I'm not quite sure which two horses they were, but he'd won on the inside, he'd won coming down the outside, and he had Harzan, and he had him running straight, and he refused to flinch, and he just kept him going and going and going, and he was sure he was going to be taken by either of the O'Brien horses. But he, in the Aga Khan suits, he just kept his horse on a straight line, and it was so courageous and so sort of disciplined. And then towards the end, about 50 yards from the post, he actually began to go away a little bit. And that was a very special ride. And then, of course, Harrison won the Irish Derby a couple of weeks later to do that very difficult double. And as you know, the O'Brien's horses have been really, really strong and dominating those races. And as O'Brien said during the week, we threw everything at Pat's Mullen that day. And he saw us off. And that was, you know, O'Brien's a competitor. Very sad. I mean, I think for me as well, John, and you probably were there last year at the Curragh. I couldn't make it, but I watched it on television when they had the Cancer for Charity trials race day, charity day, as part of the sort of the Champions weekend. And it very quickly it became the race of the weekend. And even though you had the Champions Stakes at Leopardstown and you had the St. Ledger and you had three or four other Group Ones, the Matron and other races, the race that everybody was talking about was Pat's Mullen's race. And you had the elite jockeys of jump racing and flat racing, McCoy and Walsh and Carberry and Richard Hughes, Kieran Fallon. All the greats were going to ride the Curragh, and they were going for Pat's Mullen. And McCoy was the man who had said he would never ever get on a horse ever again. And here he was prepared to do it for Pat's Mullen. And little things like that I think was mentioned in the Sunday Times today. A little small mention by Don McLean, but he says the stable staff that day, they get prizes for the best turned out horses over the weekend, and they donated those prizes to the Cancer Trials Ireland Fund. So it was just a little gesture. But so you had the elite jockeys, you had the people who, you know, get the horses to look as good as they can on the day, and they were giving what they could. And they had hoped to raise, I think, about $1 million, but they ended up raising, I think, as Don McLean,
2.6,
which was extraordinary. And Smullen was there. And we watched that race in the rain, and the guys, they're all a little chirpy beforehand. You know, there's a bit of banter. But as soon as they got going, their game faces came on. They all wanted to win. They wanted to win it for Pat's Mullen. And, of course, McCoy had to do it. You know, the iron horse, the iron jockey, the iron man. And that, to me, was moving. But very sad. Everybody will miss him terribly. A 9-time Irish champion jockey. Universally liked by everybody, respected. And he had a really tough battle. I mean, when we heard the diagnosis and you hear the word pancreatic cancer, and anybody who's any knowledge of issues, medical issues, would have known that was a huge fight for Pat to have to climb to come through. And he did, and he fought like a lion. He fought like Harrison did at the Derby in the Curragh and at Epsom. And it's a huge loss for Irish racing, huge loss for Irish sport, and a reminder that we should be thankful of every day that we are blessed with good health.
Absolutely, Philip, well said. I think dignity, class and bravery is what shone through from Pat's Mullen, Cliona. It reminds me a bit, it's a little bit of a different circumstance of the Terry Fox story. This was the guy who, ran across from the east to the west. He wanted to run from the east to the west coast of Canada, and he passed away during the attempt. But he kept going, and he became a national hero in Canada in the early 1980s. And for Pat to be so selfless and to have that idea around the race day and the raising the money for cancer trials, and the actual tangible, they've got a new machine in Vincent's Hospital. They've got a new system are coming in now in Ireland, and it's very, very tough to read that sometimes actually somebody has made even in a way a sacrifice by their own actions in bearing this and helping other people into the future.
I think in both pieces that I read in the Sunday Times, Don McLean and Eamon Sweeney in the Sunday Independent, Philip used the word sincerity, and that really comes across in both articles. And it seems like the person he was off his horse on the ground, that genuine, humble, sort of steadfast individual. And from what I'm reading, people would say he rode the same way, that he rode in a non-dramatic, efficient, controlled manner, got himself in the right place, and a very consistent jockey over his time. And like every single thing is about what he was like as a human being, and the small things they're talking about his from Offaly and involved in the local GA club and Eden Derry Town, and just well liked by everybody. And isn't that what people say, that a measure of who you are, no matter if you're one of the greatest jockeys in Ireland, but how you treat people. And by the sounds of it, anybody who came across Pat Smullen, he treated them exceptionally well. And that charity race, because if you're talking about the best jockeys in Ireland, and they're all turning up, and none of them for a second would consider not turning up to his charity race, and turn up with a heart and a half to give to his cause and what he was trying to do, just says a lot about him as a person and the legacy and the impact. He can be obviously fierce competitors with other jockeys, but at the end of it, he was an exceptional human being by the sounds of it.
Absolutely. Well said, Cliona, and may he rest in peace. This is from Shane Ross, the former Minister for Sport in the Sunday Independent. I'll just hold it up here. Delaney's long personal party at the FAI's expense. So just the Football Association was left with a legacy of debt and an old guard addicted to privilege, writes Shane Ross. Amid all the applause for the host that night in Kilkenny, this is referring to John Delaney's 50th birthday. Delaney himself knew that the FAI under his stewardship was secretly heading for bankruptcy. To his apparent credit, I still saw him at local football games mixing with the grassroots. He seemed to be firmly grounded, willing to spend his weekends cavorting with the captains and the kings of global football while using his weekends to visit smaller clubs. And no one suspected what horrors lurked hidden under the FAI bonnet, waiting to be discovered. That's just some parts of the Shane Ross. I actually have the book here, Champagne Football, that Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan have written. And just this is quotes in the book. I don't hear people giving out, said Shane Ross, in an interview on the station. This is a few years ago. I read all about it in the press, all right. There's a lot of criticism about John Delaney. My own experience is that when I go to these local games in the constituency on the ground, I see John Delaney and representatives of the FAI all the time. They're always on the ground doing things or relating to these really important things that young people are doing. So I suppose one of the things that I kind of have taken away from this and all the revelations that have shocked many people, Philip, is that corporate governance wasn't there at the FAI, but the oversight of that may not have been there to the extent that it should have. I think the corporate governance issues have been resolved, and now we've got a new CEO to come in. His name is Jonathan Hill, and what he'll be tasked with doing is sorting out the commercial side of the FAI, because if you're reading some of the Sunday paper, like once again in your paper again today, like the IRFU and the GA are were in a sound financial position, and they're, you know, ringing the alarm bells about COVID. It's costing the IRFU 5 million a month. The GA will need effectively to get a 19.5 million euro support system in place for the GA championships to take place between now and the end of December, which I think everybody will want from a morale point of view in the country. But the FAI are not exactly in that healthy position because of what's gone on. And I think what I'm reading in the newspaper here in the Sunday Independent is all really well and good, but and maybe people can say that UEFA and FIFA would automatically come in and say you can't interfere. But I think what we've seen is that oversight is crucial.
Yeah, it's a delicate one, John, and I know where you're coming from on this one. You know, the FAI have relied very heavily on funding from Sport Ireland, which is the government's arm for funding all associations in Ireland. And Shane Ross was in charge of that for the tenure of the previous government. You know, he did pop up at lots of events, internet matches in the Irish international team, including the European finals of 2016. I'm not quite sure about his conversion. You know, why wasn't he asking quite harder questions? I'd like to know that. And now, in fairness, when it all erupted in March of 2019, he certainly was very active, and governance was his catchphrase, with a capital G. But I'm kind of wondering what he was doing for a couple of years before that. You know, Sport Ireland and the FAI's auditors, you know, Sport Ireland would have got the FAI's books every year, the FAI's accounts every year. They could have gone through them with a fine tooth comb and just sort of seen was anything amiss, anything look a little out of place. I'm not a financial whiz at all. I'm a past maths person, I'll be honest with you there. I study, when I look at balance sheets, I'm really not sure what I can see, what other people can see, who are much more forensic than I am. But there was clearly things that weren't quite right. I mean, I've written about this and it does come up in the book, you know, that, you know, for example, the Sports Direct money that the FAI, that Delaney had suddenly conjured up out of a sleeve, and he said, okay, we have this, and you know, that became a 6.5 million that was appearing in the books as sort of a sponsorship, but it was effectively a loan. They had to pay it back. When Sport Ireland pulled out, they had three years to pull out, and they pulled out, and now the FAI are still paying that money back, but the money had already disappeared. But look, there is governance certainly has improved in the FAI, I will say that. I know you've had a lot of people talking about the book, about champagne football, and about the great work that Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan have done. But I think other people maybe could look at themselves and see what could they have done. I mean, journalists, including myself and a lot of others, we asked questions, we were muzzled, we were warned off, and maybe people who were, you know, in powerful positions in terms of checking imbalances for the FAI's books, in terms of grants for the FAI, maybe they should be doing a little bit more. But certainly Ross did in the year that before the election, and from March 19, he was very determined that the old guard had to go, and Delaney had to go with them, and it has gone. And look, we're trying to move on. I think we've had a lot of think tanks, and we've had a lot of committees, and we've had a lot of you know, we're now in a situation where we've had interim CEOs, deputy interim CEOs, and now Gary Owens is not going forward. Now Quinn is also going. And the FAI, finally, their last permanent CEO was John Delaney, who stepped down on the night of the Ireland-Gibraltar game at the end of March 2019. And the Football Association is about to have its next permanent CEO to be announced probably next week. Jonathan Hill is his name, an Englishman, Leeds United supporter. So he shares that in common with Roy Barrett, the independent FAI chair. He brings a strong track record of business, on the business side of football. I worked at the FA around Euro 96, around the launch of Club Wembley, and has a strong proven track record of delivering big sponsorships for the English FA. He's also worked with IMG and Kentaro and Laureus. So he's got a really strong track record of sport and business together. I think that's why he probably got the job ahead of Sarah Keane. Was very strongly fancied CEO of Swim Ireland and senior figure in the Olympic Federation of Ireland. But I think the fact that Hill has a track record of football and business together, and the FAI need deals. I mean, Shane McGrath in the Mail on Sunday makes a point that the IRFU's big sponsorship at the moment is 5.1 million, I think it is.
Vodafone, yeah.
Vodafone, and the FAI's big sponsorship is less than a quarter of that, with three, and three are pulling out. So you have the FAI's main senior sponsor is coming, say they'd stay on until the end of the year, but they're gone. The League of Ireland, SSE Electricity, they're gone at the end of this season. So there's two big vacancies there for big sponsors for the FAI. And the FAI are entering in their 100th year next year. Technically, this is the 100th year of the FAI Cup, sponsored by Extra.ie, and also the 100th year of the League of Ireland. But because we had two FAI Cups 1 year and two leagues, but next year is the anniversary of the League of the FAI being founded. It was founded in 1921, and you know, Irish football needs something big to happen next year on the commercial side. It needs a big sponsorship of the international teams, and probably you might see a separation with the ladies getting. Who are to me, it's a very undeveloped resource in terms of women's football that should have been brought on a lot more. They're getting there, and Vera Post is doing a good job, good result yesterday, never mind the scoreline. You might see two sponsorships coming in there, and the League of Ireland is a new sponsorship, and the FAI Cup, Extra.ie, are the sponsors at the moment. We'll see what happens next year. So these are big challenges for Jonathan Hill to come in. He has to, you know, deliver big deals. And if you look at the salary he's on, is actually very modest. It's a senior civil service equivalent.
Benchmarked, yeah.
Yeah, benchmarked by state. So it's 207, 209. Delaney at his peak was on 462. You know, with ridiculous expense allowances that were signed off. We all know about them. So Hill's got a big challenge. I think if he delivers big deals, John, he'll get percentages of them. So that'll boost things up a little bit. But look, a big challenge for him, and I think Irish football will wish him well. And I think he's coming in at the right time. There'd be a lot of goodwill towards him. But huge, I mean, you've touched upon it. Income for League of Ireland clubs is all 80% is based on attendances. And there's nobody going to games at the moment. Until we can get people back in, I think that's going to be a problem for the international team, the League of Ireland, as it is for the GAA and the IRFU. I wish Hill well. And I think the fact that he's coming from across the way, he's got no baggage here in Ireland. I think that's a positive. Yeah. And he'll start with a clean slate and everybody rowing in behind him. But he'll be judged on what he delivers off the field.
Okay, Philip and Cliona, we got to take a break. We got a funny story about Philip Walton to lighten the tone on the Sunday Paper Review after this.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Welcome Welcome back to the Sunday Paper Review. John Duggan with you in the company of the Irish Daily Mail football correspondent Philip Quinn and the former All-Ireland Ladies winner goalkeeper with Dublin, Cliona O'Connor, now a coach with the Dublin Senior Hurlers. Cliona, I suppose you're in blue there, but hopefully that's for Dublin, maybe not for Leinster today, given the the post-mortems that are all over the Sunday papers about what is, it was a shock defeat, really, in a way, to Saracens. We all thought Leinster were invincible.
We did indeed, we did. And it didn't turn out that way. There's some good coverage in the papers today. The Independent, then, Neil Francis, has a good piece. I think all of them, what comes across, came across to me reading them, they all really describe the tempo of the game quite well, because, you know, you start off with a first half and the very start of the game, a little, whatever, misread, miscommunication by Devon Toner. All of a sudden, Saracens are storming ahead in the first half, and little errors and penalty penalty scrums and all this sort of stuff clocking up for Leinster. And in fairness, there's some really good descriptions of that. Neil Francis is a bit, he's talking about sort of watching Leinster, and even though there's no, and maybe I think sometimes when there's no crowd in it, you can really feel the players on the pitch, and you can really sense what's happening on the pitch a little bit more when there isn't the cauldron of the stadium happening. Neil says every little victory turned into shouting in a roaring match with backslaps and meaningful stares into the eyes of their own players. He felt that Leinster's strength of character was slowly seeping away. It was like that they were really trying to lean on all the things that they're so good at and pride themselves, the body language and little wins and emphasising those to try and build some momentum. But then on the far side of it, you had Saracens. And he's saying here, Saracens too were far smarter in contact, and the ability of their players who came second and third into the ruck changed the game. Every half chance was taken advantage of, and on the ground they played with generosity of a pawnbroker and compassion of an icicle. They gave Leinster nothing. I thought that was a really good description. And then you have the second half where Leinster are making changes, and they're coming back into it. They get back within about five points, I think it was, about 48, 49 minutes. And that vigour and that enthusiasm is starting to build and build and build. But again, the description of Saracens just being able to apply pressure, and nearly with every, the more they had to defend, the more it seemed to energise them rather than it being energy sapping. The longer they were able to maintain their defence, it strengthened their resolve in terms of getting them over the line. So I think Neil Francis' piece in the Indo, and then in the Times, then you've Peter O'Reilly and Stuart Barnes as well. That same thing describing that tempo, and Stuart Barnes then compares it to the World Cup of South Africa's defeat of England in the World Cup, which is just an interesting comparison in terms of that same steely, pressurised performance of an underdog against everybody who we thought were the favourites, Leinster in this case, and England in the World Cup.
Absolutely, yeah. Street wisdom, I think, was the word. The words Neil used, which was quite good, I thought, and he's an excellent writer, and it's just very disappointing, isn't it? It's just this one really hurts, he says, which is and I think Leinster will take a while for them to get over this. I think it will take a while for them to deal with the fact that they've fallen short against Saracens for the second year in a row.
Yeah, you would imagine so, and some of the nature of some of the errors they made and what they pride themselves on in terms of performing and their standards, and I think that came across. They were really, really trying and really trying to go back to basics, and especially in that second half, and maybe it's, sometimes in these scenarios people say if the game had gone on 5 or 6 minutes longer, you know, they might have gotten over the line, they might have found a way, but it didn't. You know, they ran out of time. And I think Leo Cullen said that in one of his interviews, saying, you know, we left ourselves with a mountain to climb, and it was just too much of a job to do for them.
There's a good piece in the Sunday Times about Philip Walton, Philip Quinn. I thought this was quite entertaining stuff.
Yeah, Philip and I got back a long way. We were in the Cub Scouts together in Malahide.
Very good.
Not today or yesterday, I have to say, tell you. He's a top fella, Philip, I have to say. And yeah, there's a nice little piece. Dennis Walsh, brings us back to Oak Hill in Rochester in 1995. And let's not forget that this was supposed to be Ryder Cup week this week. John, maybe, you know, if things have been different, we might have been over in...
Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin. I listened to Pádraig Harrington. But not to be. Yeah, so it's, 25 years, Oak Hill, Rochester, and, you know, a little tie-in at New York. That's where we are this week for the US Open, and McIlroy trying to turn around a six-shot deficit tonight. But, yeah, the Ryder Cup in 95, and Walton played in the foursomes with Ian Woosnam, and then didn't play again until the singles. And he kind of felt a little bit marginalised, and it was his first Ryder Cup. He probably should have played 4 years earlier. He was left out by Tony Jacklin very controversially, despite having more birdies than anybody else in the European Tour. And he gets his break 4 years later. But he kind of talks about being a bit of a rookie, keeping his head down. And Dennis Walls quotes him as saying that, you know, as a rookie, it was no fun. He said there was a lot of... S.T. going on at the time. He said Faldo was going through a divorce. There were two or three clicks, so I just kept my head down, he said, you know, floating around. And he had a lot of time for Sam Torrance, for Woozy, and also for Constantino Rocca. But he makes a point of Monty, he says, you wouldn't want to get to know him, really. You wouldn't be going out with him on a night anyway, which kind of gives the impression that Monty wasn't the great team player that perhaps he'd like us to think he was when he says, you know, the Ryder Cup, that's what my career was all about. In fact, Monty, US Open, what happened in Wingfoot in 2006.
Disaster, tragedy.
That final hole, John, we can have half an hour debate what happened in that final hole. And Harrington admits he got away with that final hole a bit lightly because he was kind of finished a bit earlier. But back to Walton, anyway, so he's in a singles match, and the singles list is put up on the board the night before, and Europe are in a strong position here, and he's down at number, I think he's number 10 or number 11, and he's up against Jay Haas, and he walks up the room, because he told me the story himself. He walked up to the room and he got a pen, or he got not a piece of chalk, just a pen, and he wrote up on the board, "We will win," and silence, then walked back down into his seat, and they all looked at him, and they all looked at him. He says, "Yep, we will win." So it was kind of a little positive sort of psychological lift from him to the rest of the team room. Now, he wouldn't have been a very demonstrative sort of guy, Philip, although very good form when you're with him. Anyway, he was going out, and he saw he was near the end of the field, and he kind of thought, you know, Bernard Gallagher has put me out at the end because he thinks it'll all be over by the time it comes to me. And he front-loaded his team, Gallagher. So he had Langer, and he'd Woosnam, and he'd Seve, and he had Faldo all out ahead of him. I think Seve was put out first because he was playing so badly, and they kind of said to Seve, try and stay out there for as long as you can. So Walton is, anyway, tipping along in front of Jay Haas, two men and a dog, and bit by bit, people start coming back to their match, and obviously because the Yanks have closed right up, and suddenly he realises he's three up with three to play, and people are all gathered around him, and he's a chance to win the Ryder Cup. And I think Haas, from memory, chips in from a bunker, hits a pin, drops down, and then Walton has a putt on the 17th, which he flunks from about 4 feet, and now he's one up playing the last. And there's an army of people around the tee, and he knows it's all down to him. And he's one match behind. I think Johansson is playing Mickelson, but it all comes down to Philip Walton. And you kind of forget that this is extraordinary pressure. And he admits himself that his shot off the tee was a fade up the left-hand side and back onto the fairway. It was a sort of dogleg right to a raised green. And he didn't trust himself to hit the fade because he could see all the people down the left-hand side. And he felt if he necked it, if he pulled it, he could kill somebody. So he played it in the middle of the fairway with the fade and ends up in the rough. The only consolation for him was that Jay Haas, whom he didn't get on particularly well with in the match, because as Dennis Wald points out, Haas made him hold a sort of a 1 foot putter, a 2 foot putter, one of the early greens. Haas walked off the green after asking Walton to hold it. Very unsportsmanlike. You know, you ask him to hold a putt, you wait, you see them hold it. But he walked off the green. So anyway, I don't think they were the best of pals during the game. But on the 18th tee, after Philip has hit the ball into the rough on the right, Haas hits it way left. It's Gonsville. And he was stuck behind trees. And he took about 20 minutes before he played his next shot. Anyway, Philip needed a half. He got the half. He won the Ryder Cup. And that was his highlight of his career. He admitted himself he never really came back after that. But it's a lovely story. It's a little reminder where we might have been this week, looking forward to the Ryder Cup, looking forward to Harrington against Stricker, looking forward to Rory against Captain America in Wisconsin. It's not there, but Dennis has brought us back to a lovely little Irish story of a Ryder Cup success story. And fair play to Philip Walton. He delivered for Europe that day, and you can never take that away from him.
Yeah, and what interests me about it, Cliona and Philip, it was no fun, not at all. I was just delighted it was all over, the stress of it. And I'm then reading Darren O'Sullivan in the same newspaper, the former Kerry All-Ireland winning captain. I definitely wasn't enjoying it. It had become too serious. I was saying to someone in the build-up to the Crokes game, I won't tune in until the night before. It was a couple of years ago, I was with Kerry, I'd be thinking there's pressure on me to play well. There's not. The game doesn't change. I would be overthinking things. And also, you have to act a certain way as well. You can't be going out acting the maggot or with a few buddies messing around. You got to curtail yourself a small bit and carry yourself a certain way. That can be draining at times too, trying to be the person you're supposed to be. Sometimes we forget that even though sports people are, you know, you think they're in the dream job, enjoying it is not always part of the bargain.
Definitely not. And I suppose here's a bit of a secret. A badly kept secret is that a lot of time elite sport is no crack. I was down in Kerry there a couple of weeks ago, and with a friend of mine who used to play for Kerry, and we're down in Carrigsbeen, and I'm thinking of Darren being in Kerry. Everybody wants to talk football. Everybody wants to talk football, and I imagine being down there, and he talks about his injuries and not playing particularly well, and you can definitely see how there is a pressure to be a certain way. Oh, you're the fella that used to play for Kerry, and very conscious of your position as a role model and an ambassador for your county and inter-county, and there's so many fabulous things about whether you're a GAA player or a professional golfer or a footballer or whatever. There's wonderful things about it for sure, but there is another side to it. Definitely the stress of performance, and Philip there talks about being on the tee box and that, like his last hole there, you know, wins the Ryder Cup, but it's a hole full of imperfections. He doesn't have the guts to play the shot he wants. His Haas absolutely hits a horrendous shot off the tee box. So it's elite sport. You prepare for perfection, and you want to have an amazing round, but sometimes you just scrape by, you know. And Darren gives a very honest interview about his time with Kerry and all his injuries. He'd horrific hamstring injuries and all sorts of things, and he describes now going back playing with his club and not having any injuries and really, really enjoying it, and describes the seriousness around Kerry and the weight and the pressure to perform, and now being back just a club footballer. I suppose the reality is club football is never going to be as physically demanding as intercounty football, and if you are a man and an athlete of Darren's ability, who's going to have the tactical and technical skill that he does, you can get yourself around on a club pitch without having to go push your body 100%, I would imagine. So he would have the game nous to be able to stand out for his club and not to have to put his body to the lengths that he would have had to at intercounty level. And you hear that often. Intercounty players go back to their clubs and find this newfound love of the game and nearly return to, geez, this is what it's all about. This is the love of the game. And I just go out and play, because they're probably better than a lot of club players they're coming up against. And they can probably move around the pitch with an intelligence that they've earned from playing intercounty for so long.
We don't have much time left, Cliona, just a couple of minutes. We saw that positive test in Donegal. You're now back helping out with the Dublin Hurlers and coaching. Are they enjoying it, and are they okay playing in a COVID environment?
I think every intercounty GAA player, as the summer has progressed and the uncertainty has progressed, and will we have a championship or will we not? Everybody's delighted to be back training. We've 1 week under our belt now, and the club championships are happening in Dublin in about 40 minutes, I'd say. Cooler take on Ballyboden. So at the end of next week, we'll have our full panel back together. One positive thing, in a COVID environment, our office or our workspace is outdoors, which immediately makes things easier. From a COVID perspective, it immediately you don't have to deal with close indoor spaces. So at the minute, we're just, and every GAA person I think is just delighted that we're back training together and preparing for an All-Ireland series, whether it will be behind closed doors, and so be it. But there's a joy in being back playing the sport that for many months we didn't think we would see it in 2020.
Well, Cian O'Connor and Philip Quinn, we just scratched the surface today because of the fact that we got the brilliant Chelsea-Liverpool game coming on. I'm delighted that you got the helicopter in the background there, Philip, for Sam Bennett. We've been hearing it through our radio this afternoon. And delighted to talk to you again, but both of you, Irish Daily Mail's Philip Quinn and Cian O'Connor. Former All-Ireland winner with the Dublin A's footballers and now coaching with the Dublin senior herders. Thanks so much for joining us on the pay-per-view today and speak soon.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.